Marie Therese Dominguez in New York State, Commissioner for Transportation. Welcome. Appreciate everyone taking the time to join us today. And the members of the Transportation Advisory Panel, thank you again for your time. Thank you to the public who's tuning in. Today is our second public engagement listening session for the Transportation Advisory Panel. And before we jump into that, we're going to be reviewing the strategies that are presently under development by the panel, and then open it up for public comment. So we'll call on folks who have pre-registered, notifying us that they have specific comments to share. We'll do that first. And then we have to have plenty of time to open up the discussion to anybody else who may wish to provide a comment directly to the Transportation Advisory Panel. If you've not pre-registered to speak today, please enter your name and affiliation in the Q&A function of WebEx, and we'll call on you after the pre-registered guests, after we've gone through that list, and as time permits. So that gives you a sense of our agenda. We'll do a little bit of welcome and introductions, and again, an overview of the strategies that we're dealing with right now, and then engage in a larger public discussion. All right, next slide, please. So everybody knows the rules of the road here. Please mute yourself if you're not speaking, and we'll make sure that we get to everybody appropriately. If you have any problems technically, please reach out to jesse.way, J-E-S-S-E.way, at cadmusgroup.com. We've had some problems both the last meeting and obviously with this meeting with connectivity. So if anybody's having a problem, reach out to Jesse directly. Thank you. All right, next slide. So just want to make sure that we've got a lot of folks here. I think I saw Paul Allen. Is LG Holstein with us? Corrine? All right. Demetrius, I saw. Demetrius, is Renee with us? All right. Julie, I see. Steve Finch, Corey, Craig Turner, are you with us? And Albert, I heard you. John is not able to make it. Nancy Young, I heard you join. Kendra, are you able to join us today?
Hi, Commissioner, I'm on today.
Great, thank you. Nick Cifuentes. And I think Bob is gonna join us in a few minutes. Okay, so we've got a good number of folks. I know a few people are gonna be joining us late. Is there somebody that I missed? Jared.
I'm here, Commissioner.
Okay, great.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My apologies. All right. And I just flipped the pictures, and Ron, I can see your bright pink. It looks fantastic. A little cheer for the afternoon.
It's spring, come on.
I know. We're gonna pretend that it is already. The sun is shining. All right, so let's jump into it. To the next slide, please. So let's go through the strategies that the Transportation Advisory Panel presently has under consideration. They really fall into four areas. If you could go to the next slide, that we've been focusing our efforts on. So we'll start off with electrification and cleaner fuels. And I'll ask Adam if you could please go through what we're looking at here in terms of the draft material, some of these draft recommendations that we're looking at and seeking comment on. So Adam Reuter.
Yes, thank you, Commissioner. Thank you all for joining us today. It looks like we've got a great group. So on electrification and cleaner fuels, we really are focused on policies that can speed up the transition to zero emission vehicles through a combination of both mandates and supporting policies that can help us get there. We also recognize that there's a need for other clean fuels as well, especially during the transition period to zero emission vehicles. So for light duty vehicles, this includes a 100% ZEV sales mandate, like what California is looking to implement, 100% ZEV sales by 2035. Other supporting strategies that could include incentives and or a similar concept called feebates, ZEV awareness building activities, and other elements to really spur the market on. Medium and heavy duty vehicles and non-road vehicles, similarly looking toward California's mandate through the Advanced Clean Trucks rule, that would have an increasing percentage of trucks sold being zero emission vehicles, and other supporting strategies, including financing, incentives, and focusing on specific types of fleets and how we can target some of those for especially early adopters. We recognize that with all this, all these additional zero emission vehicles, there will be a need for charging and fueling stations and a required investment in those. Those we expect could be supported by clean fuels regulations, such as the clean fuel standard that treats electricity as a clean fuel and can help generate revenue and money to invest in these types of fuels and fueling infrastructure. We also recognize that there may be a need for utility rate changes that can encourage the efficient use of the money for infrastructure to make sure that we are getting managed charging and not overwhelming the electric grid, and also making sure that the infrastructure is going in a cost-effective manner. All of this needs to be looked at through an equity perspective, through looking at how do we make sure that the clean vehicles that are being put on the road are made available to all and have impacts across the state and not just in pockets. So things like enhanced incentives for low and moderate income customers or used EV incentives, targeting truck and bus incentives to fleets that are based or operate in disadvantaged communities, potential for green zone type strategies where you have an area, a low emission area, maybe around a port facility or something like that. And then we're also, as I mentioned, looking at other fuels as well and ways to get more clean renewable fuels into the market instead of gasoline and diesel until we get to zero emission fuels. But also focusing on cleaner renewable fuels for the long term, especially for hard to electrify use cases. So these would also benefit from the potential clean fuels regulation that I mentioned earlier. Thank you, Commissioner.
Okay, thank you, Adam. All right, now we're going to go to public transportation. And Ron Epstein, our Executive Deputy Commissioner here at New York State DOT, is going to go through this.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. I hope you're doing well. As we've been discussing, our goal here is to ensure that, we implement policies and strategies for consideration by the Climate Action Council that would significantly enhance the availability of public transportation, especially in underserved or unserved communities. And one of the ways we're proposing to do that is basically to double the availability of public transportation. That can be in terms of service hours, can be in terms of routes, can be in terms of destinations served. The mix and balance will be determined based on the specific community, but the goal goal is to invest in, you know, higher quality, higher reliable services. One of the ways that we have been focusing on to help develop recommendations is to facilitate more of a holistic community approach to reducing the environmental footprint on of transportation on communities. And the way to do that, for the most part, is through transportation-oriented development. And what we're looking there, at, you know, at in terms of transportation-oriented development is how do you integrate the existing or planned network, transportation network? How do you configure facilities and other, you know, amenities into the community so that it is something that is convenient, which I'll talk about in a little bit. But basically, you know, looking at the density, the design, the distance, and the destination as you're, you know, assessing how to plan and enhance services. Another aspect is the convenience and connectivity of the service. You know, this is all about, you know, high quality amenities for the passengers, making sure that, you know, they are they have appropriate seating, heat, lighting, security, whatever it is they need for making this a mode of choice. Certainly, you know, we want to reimage and rebrand services so they incorporate into the community. And basically, as we've said time and time again, every transit trip begins with a pedestrian trip. So making sure that the infrastructure is in place for walking, biking, access to where those transit stations, those transit stops are. And again, I think part of this has to do with the fact that as we move forward in terms of recommending strategies complementing the transit-oriented development is how do you align the support services, the stations, the stops into roadway and community development? In terms of measuring the investments, there are a number of ways in terms of how we would go about measuring, and with your input, we'll hone in on very specific recommendations. But the first thing we need to recognize is that the current way that transportation investment is measured today, and this is across the nation, it really looks at the automobile trip and the level of service and the average speeds. What we need to look at is how do we include equity? How do we include avoided emissions, health considerations. It might be things such as, you know, how many jobs within a so many minute commute from a transit station, what percentage of the community lives within maybe, you know, half a mile of a transit stop, so that, you know, we are looking at measures that, you know, provide inclusiveness and the ability to enhance access. So that's something that would be looked at. Practicality, you know, transit, you know, I'm personally from downstate originally, and, you know, public transportation is one of those things where you either know how to use it or you don't know how to use it. We need to break down the barrier of communication in public transportation, and that includes having, you know, integrated media for fares. You know, it could be connected between, you know, nice bus on in Nassau County that is also accepted on the Long Island Railroad, or it might be Westchester County B-Line integrating into the New York City Transit, as is done now with, you know, Omni. So there are different types of integrated fare media and mobile fare payment options that need to be considered, as well as app-based technologies that are available to everybody that provide real-time information so that you know that the bus is arriving in 10 minutes or 20 minutes or 5 minutes, and then you're not just waiting there, you know, for the next bus to come, or you don't know where that bus route is actually heading. So trying to enhance the practicality. And then in terms of fleet modernization, clearly part of the solution here is procuring zero emission vehicles. It might be, you know, partnering with communities to right size the type of vehicle that's appropriate for certain routes, and also considering, you know, where vehicles are stored, how they're stored, and ensuring that the fleet has the reserve energy that it needs so that it can actually serve its intended purpose. How we do all these things certainly remains subjects for consideration, but it all goes to ensuring that, you know, it is something that is accessible, convenient, reliable, and practical. You know, the fleet modernization, people expect today, they expect that you have Wi-Fi. They expect that you have certain amenities in terms of safety. And they also expect the ability to do other activities, whether it might be doing work, schoolwork, whatever it might be. So making sure that, you know, you can charge your devices as you're riding to your destination. So those kinds of little things that you may see in other modes today, bringing them, you know, to the forefront along all services for public transportation. So with that, I'll stop, Commissioner, and we can go on to the next slide.
Thank you, Ron. It's very comprehensive. All right, we'll turn to Paul Beyer from New York State Department of State to walk us through the smart growth strategies that are under consideration. Paul? Paul? Paul Beyer.
It looks like he's muted.
There you go. Paul, are you muted? There you go. Paul, can you hear us? All right, we will reach out to Paul. And let's go on to financing and market-based programs, and we'll circle back to Paul.
Okay, sounds good. Hi, everyone. This is Jared Snyder, and, you know, welcome today. I'm looking forward to the comments this afternoon from the members of the public. So the financing and market-based programs effort is really focused on identifying mechanisms, policies that would support the policy goals of the other work groups. So, you know, one primary example is financing strategies that enable businesses or other institutions, even public institutions, to invest in electric trucks and buses. And, you know, these are vehicles that have, you know, a higher upfront cost, but over time, there's savings in reduced fuel consumption, in reduced maintenance costs. So are there financing mechanisms that can sort of bring forward those savings over the life of a vehicle and enable businesses to invest in those, you know, trucks and buses up front and you know, really start reaping the benefits of electrified transportation. And so, you know, we're you know, working with experts to identify, you know, what some of those strategies would be and what policies the state can put into effect that enable those investments to take place. And then we're also looking at are there market-based policies that we should be considering that would support the overall transition we're talking about here. So the transition to zero-emission vehicles, expanded public transportation, smart growth, cleaner fuels. You know, are there you know, market-based mechanisms that would help achieve the goals, the policy goals identified in those other work areas? And with a particular focus on, you know, if we do recommend some of those market-based policies, you know, Adam identified low carbon fuel standard, for example. If we do, you know, pursue some of those policies, you know, how can they be structured to provide a particular focus on benefits to, you you know, underserved and disadvantaged communities. The CLCPA, the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, requires at least 35% to 40% of benefits to go to those communities, and that is a laudable goal. And you know, we're evaluating, you know, through any mechanisms we put in place, how to achieve that goal. So hopefully that gave enough time for Paul to find his mute key and go back to the prior slide.
Okay, thank you, Jared. I greatly appreciate it. Have we double unmuted Paul so that he can join us?
Yes, I found my way.
Okay, wonderful.
All right. Well, the smart growth and public transportation subgroups are very much conjoined, and we are following the phrase that Ron used of developing some type of a holistic approach to community development. More specifically, how do we bring together these worlds, these entities that are involved in both public transportation and land use? And when I say land use, ideally, you know, smart growth land use configurations. How do we bring public transportation, land use planning and development, and economic development together? Because those are the folks that are going to have to coordinate to get to this holistic approach. And what we're finding is they are not necessarily the entities that are coordinating early in the process, early in the local planning process, early in the business recruitment process, the local tax incentive process through the IDAs. So we had a joint meeting of both of these subgroups, which I found was very productive, because we are trying to figure out ways, again, mechanisms, policies, incentives, to make sure that we're not chasing development, to use Ron's phrase. We are getting in early and trying to align transit and land use with our economic development goals. The overall concept of public transportation-oriented development really strikes at the core of smart growth. It's just an expanded version of transit-oriented development, and it goes to the goal of the land use and local government panel to reduce car dependence in several different ways, get people walking, biking, but certainly get them onto public transportation. And if we can align our economic development goals with local planning, regional planning, and regional transit agencies, I think we're well on our way to meeting that ultimate alignment that Ron talks about, that holistic alignment, rather than taking a scattershot approach to reaching these goals. And part of our charge here is also what Ron addressed in depth, and that is that critical first mile, last mile connectivity, and that has a lot to do with land use planning also.
All right, great. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
All right, so we've provided kind of an overview of the four sectors that we're really looking at. And want to open up for a larger discussion here to make sure that we're, one, providing the overview, but two, hearing directly from the public on some of these strategies. We value and have listened over the course of the many meetings that we've had, but here is yet another opportunity. And so I know we've got some folks that are pre-registered. Just a couple rules of the road here. If you could please announce your name, the organization and or affiliation. If you're representing yourself, you're representing yourself, that's fine. As I said before, we're gonna call on those folks that pre-registered, but by all means, please, we'll have plenty of time, I believe, to hear from others who have not had the chance to register. Somebody put in the chat room, how long are we recommending in terms of comments? We're recommending about 2 minutes. if you could, just to make sure that we can hear from folks that are interested in talking. If there's additional time, you're welcome to sign up again. If you could, please put on your camera, and certainly please put on your microphone so that we can hear you. And if you don't want to speak per se, we welcome any, please put your comment or your question into the chat box. We're happy to take them. It's available here. And again, there's other opportunities besides this particular webinar that we'll be capturing comment. It's on a rolling basis. So this slide gives you some additional information about where you can email your comments. We're taking them on a rolling basis, as I said. And also we've got the larger, you know, here's the regular mail address to Transportation Advisory Panel in Albany, care of Abigail Schultz. And again, the email address at transportation.publiccomment@dot.ny.gov. Okay, so with that, I'm going to turn this over to our colleague, Alexandria Trujillo, who is going to start to work through those folks that have pre-registered. And Alex, take it away.
Thank you, Commissioner. So I'm going to start going through the list. I'll call on a name, but I'll also announce who's going to be coming up next so you can prepare. Our staff here at CADMIS is going to either elevate you or unmute you so you'll be able to speak. And with that, we will start with Sam Wade, and then Carol Lee Ron is next. And also, I apologize if I mispronounce anyone's names. Thank you.
Hi there, everyone. A pleasure to be with you today. This is Sam Wade with the Coalition for Renewable Natural Gas. We're the National Trade Association for the RNG industry in the U.S. and Canada. And I'm very happy to be here in support of a clean fuel standard alongside all of our colleagues in the Clean Fuels New York Coalition. As was mentioned in the slides today, the implementation of a CFS would support widespread deployment of a wide variety of key technologies, including renewable natural gas, to decarbonize New York's transportation sector. The CFS is a proven policy. Analogous programs have a long and successful track record in California, Oregon, and British Columbia. And based on these examples, a number of other jurisdictions, including the federal government of Canada, are also working on similar programs. So pursuing a CFS would position New York with these other leading jurisdictions and would basically set a real policy in place to motivate the changes that are needed beyond just the zero emission vehicles, but would also support the push towards zero emission vehicles in the long run. And as the waste and ag advisory panel conversations have highlighted, renewable natural gas specifically is a truly circular resource, which involves the utilization of waste methane generated by landfills, wastewater treatment plants, agricultural operations, and other anaerobic digesters. Depending on where it's sourced from, RNG can range from low carbon to carbon negative, basically better than carbon neutral from a greenhouse gas reduction standpoint. And RNG can be used in natural gas vehicles, for the production of green hydrogen, or for use in electricity production for eventual use in EVs. So we really strongly believe in all of those methods to get us off of diesel. And when RNG is used to in any of those ways to get off of diesel, it creates both local air quality benefits and greenhouse gas reductions. So supporting the use of RNG in the transportation sector through a CFS has a ripple effect, both environmentally and economically, helping to repurpose and prevent methane emissions, fund infrastructure which supports the reuse of these wastes, and provide revenues to entities like local municipalities and farmers. And therefore, a CFS presents a unique and immediate opportunity to affect real transportation decarbonization while also helping in those other sectors. And we respectfully urge the Climate Action Council to include the CFS in a scoping plan, and our industry looks forward to facilitating further GHG reductions and environmental improvements within New York. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam.
Alex, one thing I just wanted to note for the members of the Transportation Advisory Panel, if you have additional questions or whatnot, if you could just raise your hand either in the chat function in case you have questions for any of the public commenters. All right. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you, Commissioner. Up next is John Carlson from Ceres, as Carol Lee is his colleague and is not speaking. Then after John, it will be Rich Castle. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you to the panel. Appreciate the essential work you are doing to craft solutions to our climate crisis. I'm speaking on behalf of the Series Bicep Network, Businesses for Innovative Climate and Energy Policy. It's a coalition of 70 large corporations who are in general consumers of energy and transportation services rather than providers. Our members are committed to driving sustainability throughout the economy, and we have long supported a variety of clean transportation policies. I think in order to decarbonize the transportation sector, we feel we need a broad range of these policies, from better public transit to zero emission delivery trucks and port drayage vehicles. We need active transport and micromobility options that are available and easy to use for all of our citizens. We need these targeted measures that are going to clean up the dirtiest aspects of our transportation system, and particularly in those communities that are most overburdened right now. But in addition to these targeted measures, we're going to need broad systemic efforts to incentivize clean transport. We need policies that generate revenue and dedicated resources for those targeted measures. And we need policies that are holistic, that will catch the pollution that the targeted measures will inevitably miss. And we think the best way to do this is through policies that make polluters pay. The companies that I represent have all made commitments to clean up their own internal operations, to reduce the emissions that they have a responsibility for. But transportation in particular is a really difficult problem. They almost inevitably have to rely on a transportation system for moving people and goods that is outside of their direct control. There's shipping companies, logistics providers, last mile delivery services that are all burning fossil fuels right now. They have made these commitments to take responsibility for even those emissions that result from their business that are outside of their direct control. But in order to do so, they need these systemic changes. And that's why I'm here today speaking to you. We need policies that will make all of those profiting off of transportation pollution pay. Proposals such as the Low Carbon Fuel Standard achieve that and will help drive private investment and create markets for clean fuel options. And other market-based mechanisms such as the Transportation and Climate Initiative, which right now is moving forward in neighboring states, will also create those incentives. And additionally, it's going to raise revenue that goes into the state coffers that can fund the targeted measures this panel is considering. We think TCI is an efficient complement to the other policies under discussion. It doesn't replace them, but it does buttress them. It provides a dedicated revenue source and the systemic pressure we need to decarbonize that the other measures don't. We're strongly in support of electrification, transportation, expanded improving transit, zero emission vehicles, and we advocate for those positions, but we don't think LCFS or TCI in any way is in conflict with those positions. They're designed to get us to the end point of a clean transportation system. And we support the various guardrails that we think are important to put in place around these market-based solutions, including provisions in TCI that dedicates 35% of the revenue to overburdened and underserved communities, and for equity boards in each of the participating states with proper representation from communities that have a say in how those revenues are invested. Those were modeled in many ways off of the work of the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act that New York passed, something we were also very proud to support in 2019. So we hope that this panel will recommend a holistic strategy to decarbonize transportation that includes market-based mechanisms like TCI and LCFS as essential complementary policies. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, John.
All right, up next is Rich Cassell, and then after that will be Kathy Harris.
All right, thank you very much for the time. My name is Rich Cassell, and I'd like to make three brief points. I'm speaking today wearing two hats. First is director of Capilano's Clean Energy and Sustainability Group. In that role, I work with businesses and nonprofit organizations that are committed to decarbonizing New York's economy and helping New York meet its CLCPA goals. But I also wear the hat as chair of EPA's Advisory Committee on Transportation Issues. And wearing that hat, I'm deeply involved in helping the agency identify policies that can help the country meet its overall climate and transportation sector goals. And I'm going to speak today about the Clean Fuel Standard as being one of those policies. Like I said, I'll make three brief points. The first is we all know that the next decade is critical. that we simply can't wait for sector-wide electrification or any other sector-wide strategy that takes decades to happen if we are going to move the needle enough to meet our near-term and mid-term solutions as well as our long-term solutions. We need to do all three in complementary ways to avoid doing more damage in the decade ahead while we wait for sector-wide zero-emission solutions to reach scale. The Clean Fuel Standard fits squarely into this policy ecosystem. Numerous analyses have shown that there's simply no way to meet our near-term 2030 and mid-term 2040 goals without decarbonizing the fossil fuels currently used in transportation. Indeed, when I was part of the technical team that did the first 40 by 30 analysis for New York City, the surprise takeaway of that analysis was that it was obvious that we could not meet our goals without decarbonizing liquid fuels, especially diesel. Even the most ambitious electrification policies, such as last year's California Advanced Clean Truck Rule, will not move the needle enough to get there in the timeframes we're talking about here. In fact, that rule, which is described by many as a ZEV-based rule, is not quite that, because diesel fuel will still power many new trucks in California in 2035, ranging from 45% of Class B, 2B to 3 truck sales to 60% of tractor-trailer sales. So we really need to address that part of the market that will continue to use liquid fuels. Now, there's one other thing we know from California, which is that the Clean Fuel Standard works not just to drive the market away from fossil fuels, but to make sure that the replacement fuels are sustainable and low carbon for the near term and midterm. This is really important. The first generation of biofuels policies were typically just biofuels mandates, replace one fuel with another. But by shifting to a fuel and technology agnostic carbon intensity approach, the performance-based approach of the Clean Fuel Standard and California's LCFS is going to drive the biofuels world towards ever more sustainable feedstocks and production processes, and frankly, will make possible not just low carbon fuels, but carbon negative fuels, carbon neutral fuels, and all sorts of exciting new technologies and fuel processes that are being developed as I speak. The second point, and I know I need to wrap up, addresses local air pollution. That adopting a clean fuel standard will also provide critical air pollution and public health benefits right away in the low-income communities of color that are home to far too many diesel truck and bus depots and truck routes. Why is that? Because replacing petroleum diesel fuel with a renewable fuel, 100%, will reduce PM by roughly 33% on a per truck or per bus basis. The parents of asthmatic children should not have to wait until the MTA or other fleets are fully electric in 2040 before seeing this benefit in their communities. We need to do both. And last but not least, at this moment of severe state budget concerns, we need to find ways to create pools of public sector funds to supplement government spending to ensure we actually do build out the zero emission charging and other infrastructure we'll need to meet our longer term goals. We need to do that. Right now, we use 7 billion gallons of gasoline and diesel fuel, roughly, every year. If that amount of fossil fuel was sold in California today, it would generate roughly $1.4 billion in private sector dollars, which would then in turn fund the investments in zero emission charging and other clean fuel investments. This is just a pot of funding we cannot avoid being put to use. There's just no other policy tool on the radar screen that can generate that level of private sector funding while also providing the kind of near-term, mid-term greenhouse and particulate reductions that are possible with a clean fuel standard. Thank you very much for your time and all your work on all the different policies you're talking about today.
Thank you, Rich.
Up next is Kathy Harris and then Kevin Miller.
Hi, can folks hear me? Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak. My name is Kathy Harris. I'm the Eastern Clean Vehicles and Fuels Advocate for the Natural Resources Defense Council. We're an international nonprofit environmental organization with more than 3 million members. And since 1970, our lawyers, scientists, and other environmental specialists have worked to protect the world's natural resources, public health, and the environment. As the transportation sector is broad and wide-reaching and covers many sectors of the economy. We appreciate the panel's commitment to looking holistically at this sector as you develop your policy recommendations for the Climate Action Council. We're supportive of many of the draft policy recommendations presented during last week's TAP meeting, including the Advanced Clean Truck Rule and the Heavy Duty Omnibus Rule, expanding EV infrastructure, supporting light duty zero emission vehicles, especially used electric vehicles, and utility support and rate design to meet those goals. However, looking at all of the policies and programs that are necessary to get New York to net zero emissions by 2050, it's vital that the panel also consider long-term sustainable funding sources to support these efforts. The electrification subgroup noted this in their draft recommendations that was presented last week by stating that one of the risks and barriers to success for widespread transportation electrification is the potentially high cost of supporting charging infrastructure and ZEV incentives. Some of the funding recommendations from the panel, such as fee rebates, is a start, but won't achieve the levels of annual funding that are required and needed by New York to achieve its goals. That's why we encourage the panel to recommend that New York join the Transportation and Climate Initiative program and adopt the clean fuel standards. In addition to reducing emissions, the TCIP, the Transportation and Climate Initiative program, also would generate an estimated $414 million per year over the next decade for New York, which could help us build and deploy the panel's proposed policies and programs. But it's important to note that the TCIP must also be paired with other transformative transportation policies like a clean fuel standard to achieve the foundational goals of the CLCPA and ensure equitable investments and pollution reductions. Both those policies would help to fund the New York's clean transportation investments, but in different ways. TCI would provide the state with the revenue that can be invested in a wide range of transportation projects, including transit and port electrification and others, while the CFS would set a gradually tightening carbon performance standard that would promote private investments in low carbon fuels, including electricity, hydrogen, and biofuels made from wastes. And the revenues earned by utilities for providing charging for power for electric cars, trucks, and buses could then be returned to customers in the form of electric vehicle purchase rebates for deploying charging stations in disadvantaged communities, for example. Adoption of a clean fuel standard will further help to achieve the TCI emissions cap, and the TCIP can help deploy clean fuel applications like electric transit buses. Having some of these programs will also help to support other policy recommendations such as the Advanced Clean Truck Rule, and we've seen systems like this is kind of a holistic approach also work in California, which is why they've adopted a similar suite of policies. I also would just like to request that the TEP post the slides from the proposed recommendations from last week's call as soon as possible. I believe that it would give ample time for the public to comment on some of those draft recommendations, and I thank you for the opportunity to be able to speak today.
Thank you, Kathy.
Up next is Kevin Miller and then Corrine Dumit.
I just want to acknowledge that TAP member Corrine Taylor has joined us, so thank you, Corrine. Sorry, Alex, can you announce the next speaker, please?
Yep, up next is Kevin Miller.
Kevin Miller, there you are. We can't hear you, Kevin. We can see you.
I was on double secret mute. Apologies for that. So, Commissioner, to the TAP members and to myself for the third time trying to introduce myself, and now successfully for the first. I'm Kevin Miller. I'm the Director of Public Policy for ChargePoint, which is a leading provider of electric vehicle or EV charging hardware, software, and related services. ChargePoint has hundreds of thousands of chargers that are operated on our network, which we primarily don't own or operate. Those are owned and operated instead by cities, towns, counties, private fleet operators, and other local businesses. I am pleased to speak today and enthusiastically support two of the panel's proposed actions, the first being to address antiquated electricity rates that depress the deployment of EV charging infrastructure, as well as clean fuels regulations such as the proposed clean fuel standard. So with regard to the first point on electricity rates, to characterize public and private entities that invest in high power charging are typically subscribed into rates that not only recover costs for how much energy is used, but for how much energy could be used through a demand charge. And this method of doing so is not designed for the type of electricity loads that fast charging and high-powered charging stations present. So as a result, the operating costs on a monthly basis, up to 90% of those costs can be attributed to demand charges, which during early markets in particular can be challenging to adopt, and more specifically and more problematically for medium and heavy duty vehicle fleet operators, such as transit bus operators, school buses, municipal service vehicles, and delivery fleets. This can be a real challenge to not only installing and running charging infrastructure, but to even considering transitioning to zero emission vehicles. So really glad to see that this is on the table, and hope that the TAP will maintain this language. I'll note that Senator Kennedy and Assemblyman Cusick have filed legislation similarly addressing this issue, which is moving forward first through the Senate. So really appreciate that consideration. And then I'll wrap it up quickly just by noting that, you know, clean fuel standards are critically important tools to supporting the electrification of transportation. I think that they're a useful and extremely critically important technology neutral mechanism, but it's really important to note that in particular, as the grid gets cleaner, electric solutions and other zero emission transportation solutions will significantly benefit. In California, in ChargePoint's experience, the clean fuel standard equivalent out there has doubled revenues on the average level two charging station and decreased the average payback period from 6 years to less than 3 years, which really helps to incentivize significant investment, which will be necessary to achieve our CLCPA goals. So I will leave it there. Thank you very much for your time and consideration and for all of the thoughtful work that has gone in through this process.
Great. Thank you, Kevin.
All right, up next was Corrine Dumit from EVgo, but we don't see her in the participants list. So if someone else from EVgo or Corrine is present, please reach out to us and we'll come back to you. So with that, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is next, and then Kevin Grant.
Can you guys all hear me?
Yes.
Great, I'm sorry, I had signed up, but then I also had to pick up my son, so I'm in that mode, in that place in life. But I do want to echo, actually, I'm working with an organization called the Healthy Air Alliance, and I was happy to see, hear the comments to Mr. Rich Castle, so I just want to say hello to you, Rich. We've been on emails together, but also that to consider very carefully the air quality, the PM2.5, as part of the conversation, as in a way that it has not been included in the past. It's very important to me and communities that I work with. With that, I'll stop because there's a lot of other beautiful things that people said that I also echo, and I thank you guys very much.
Thank you, Ibrahim, and we could completely appreciate your multitasking. So thanks for making time today.
All right. Up next is Kevin Grant, and then Sherry Merrow. Actually, I'm seeing that Kevin Grant might not be present. If you are, please reach out to us. But with that, we will move on to Sherry Merrow and then Eric Serratini.
Thank you. Can you all hear me?
Yes, thank you. Okay,
great. Appreciate Commissioner this time to be able to talk and the time from the committee and the panel. My name is Sherry Merrow, and I'm the Director of State Government Affairs for NGV America, the National Trade Organization for the Natural Gas Vehicle Industry. I appreciate this opportunity to comment today on an effective strategy to use all clean fuels to reduce emissions from the transportation sector in the state of New York. The transportation sector is responsible for 36% of greenhouse gas emissions in New York State and is one of the only segments of the economy that has increased pollution. Reducing transportation emissions is an imperative that will have significant public health benefits and clean our air. Action is required now that we'll use all available clean technology in the transportation sector to address today's emissions problems. And a major first step to accelerate this transition is implementing a clean fuel standard, or CFS, in New York. A CFS enables incentives for the cleanest fuels to be used based on their carbon intensity. Q3 2020 data from the California Air Resources Board confirmed that the energy-weighted carbon intensity value of California's renewable natural gas, or RNG, consumed as a result of its CFS program is now below zero at minus 17.95 grams of CO2e per megajoule. Simply put, most of the RNG motor fuel being used in California in 2021 is now carbon negative, and RNG is among the lowest carbon intensity on-road vehicle fuels in use today, even better than renewable electricity derived from solar or wind. So while EVs present tremendous medium and long-term opportunities to decarbonize the transportation sector, there are significant gaps in available EV options for medium and heavy-duty vehicles. Near-zero low-NOx engines using RNG are available today for every vehicle class, and their increased deployment will immediately reduce emissions. These carbon-negative vehicles are most affordable with a mature, established refueling infrastructure already in place, meaning more vehicles on the road sooner at less public cost. It's really about using the fuels we have today that are available that will take us to the zero-emission future. Thank you for your consideration. I look forward to working together with the group in the future.
Thank you, Sherry. Greatly appreciate it. All right.
Up next is Eric Saratani, and then Alok Disa is going to be next.
All right. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Hi, my name is Eric Saratani, and I do environmental work with the Walt Disney Company, focusing on television production. So we calculate carbon footprints for our productions, and diesel fuel used in trucks and generators is often the largest source of emissions. A couple years ago, we transitioned our fleet of trucks in Southern California from fossil-based diesel to renewable diesel. And the life cycle carbon emissions are significantly lower, and it also helps to improve local air quality. The switch to renewable diesel was possible largely because of California's low carbon fuel standard, which makes it available at a competitive price. As you know, we have a lot of productions in New York, and we'd love to see a similar standard so we could take advantage of the low carbon fuels in New York as well. Eventually, we'd like to move to electric vehicles, which a low-carbon fuel standard could also help with by creating electric vehicle rebates and credits for charging infrastructure. But that'll take years. We rent from companies that will have to invest in electric vehicles, especially when it comes to trucks. The technology is still being developed. And the low carbon fuels like renewable diesel are a really important bridge for us while we work to electrify our fleets. And I also work with environmental folks from a lot of other major studios, and it's a pretty high priority for the industry as a whole. So I just wanted to express my support and thank you all for your time.
Great. Thank you, Eric.
All right, up next is Alok Disa and then Douglas Funky.
Hi, good afternoon. Can folks hear me?
Yes, great. There you are.
Right, thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you to the Transportation Advisory Panel for the opportunity to comment on these draft recommendations to the Climate Action Council. My name is Alok Disa, Senior Research and Policy Analyst with Earth Justice based out of our New York office. I want to start with a general point, and then I have a couple maybe more specific points. But I want to start with the general idea that decarbonizing the economy